From NPR and WBUR, I'm Don Gagne.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. It has been 1 week since gunmen stormed the private residence of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse, murdering him and wounding his wife. Since then, at least three people have stepped into the power vacuum, claiming a right to lead the country. Meanwhile, the investigation is ongoing, even as Haiti's humanitarian crisis is getting worse. Widlor Merencourt is editor-in-chief of the news outlet Aibo Post. We reached him by Skype in Port-au-Prince. Widlor, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Now that it's been a week since this assassination, does it feel as though the mood among people in Haiti is changing at all?
Right after the assassination, you would see a lot of tension and you would see a lot of confusion from the people. But right now, several days after, you could see that people are trying to get back to some sort of normalcy, whatever that means in a country ruled by gangs. And you can see also the gangs restarting quickly their activities. I'm hearing about several cases of kidnappings, which, you know, stopped a little bit a couple of days after the assassination, but this business is quickly restarting. People still have questions, but you can see more people in the streets right now. Of course, the worry that people have regarding their own security is still there. But the airport is reopened and you can see businesses reopen as well.
U.S. investigators arrived in Haiti on Sunday. What kind of assistance have they been able to offer officials there?
It's unclear what type of help the U.S. is providing. We just know that the U.S. is involved with the investigation. There is also this fact, at least one of the assailants who was like a informant for the DEA. So there is question about, did the DEA actually knew about some of this stuff that came out? And, you know, people are asking for transparency. And is there anything that could have been done to prevent this?
Meanwhile, as the investigation goes on, there is talk about elections in September. They are theoretically planned to happen. Here's Haiti's ambassador to the United States, Bokshi Edmond, in an interview with Morning Edition today.
We need to go to have those elections so we can renew our democratic institutions so democracy can prevail in Haiti.
At this point, are fair elections in the fall a realistic goal?
If you talk to the different stakeholders here in Haiti, I think virtually all of them will tell you that it's practically impossible to have elections in this context in Haiti. I mean, even the PHTK, the party of the actual administration, is telling you that they are skeptical about having elections in Haiti right now. It was very difficult before the assassination of the president. You have only 10 elected officials in Haiti, where you should have hundreds. Because the past president did not hold elections on time, you are in the situation you are in right now. But at the same time, large parts of Haiti are ruled by gangs. And if you were to have free and fair elections, it's practically impossible to have them when 30 to 60% of your territory is ruled by people who are more armed than your Haitian National Police.
So the political challenges are immense. So are the humanitarian challenges. UNICEF says that a third of all children in Haiti are in need of emergency supplies, things like food, water, and medical care. Not a single coronavirus vaccine has been administered. Do you think that the chaos you're describing has made Haiti's ongoing humanitarian crisis even worse?
I think there is no question. Before the assassination of the president, about 15 people were killed. And during the month of June, about 13,000 people flee their homes. And there is reason to believe that thousands more are fleeing the places of, you know, the places where they stayed because of violence. And you have 4.4 million people in Haiti in critical need for food. And at the same time, you have people who are almost unable to go, for instance, to the south of Haiti because the road is so dangerous. It's extremely difficult for help and for humanitarian people to walk and to get to those who are in need.
Woodlore Merencourt, editor-in-chief of the Haitian news outlet Aibo Post. We reached him on a Skype line in Port-au-Prince. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The debate over a COVID-19 vaccine booster shot intensifies after Pfizer said last week that a third dose may be needed within 6 to 12 months after full vaccination. But a new statement issued by the director of the World Health Organization, the WHO, says that those who have been fully vaccinated do not need a booster shot at this time. Helen Branswell has been reporting on this for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Don.
Why is the WHO director saying booster shots are not necessary right now?
A couple of reasons, probably. At present, there isn't really evidence to suggest that the vaccines aren't working well. So talking about giving some people a third shot to some people seems premature. The other thing is, of course, that there's just a huge problem with vaccine inequity in the world right now. There are many countries that are still struggling to get any vaccine, have vaccinated, you know, less than 1% of their populations. What the Director General of the WHO, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, was saying was that the world needs to vaccinate healthcare workers around the globe and the elderly around the globe and wait to talk about third doses for people in rich countries till a later date.
So it's not a ruling out of boosters forever. He's saying we should focus first on getting everyone vaccinated before developing boosters for those in mostly rich countries that have already gotten the shot. Is there anything the WHO can do to make sure that happens? Are they already trying to do that?
No, the power that they have is moral suasion, and the director general has been trying to use that for months. There has been some sharing of vaccine, but not at the scale that the WHO would like to see.
Of course, the talk of boosters doesn't just come out of the blue. Pfizer and Moderna have both said that booster shots could be necessary. What's the evidence that they have that leads them to maybe a different conclusion on boosters?
That's not clear at this point. Recently, some scientists in Israel in their Department of Health or Ministry of Health said that they were seeing some breakthrough infections among people who had been vaccinated early in Israel's vaccination process. So, you know, with them saying that they're seeing some infections among fully vaccinated people who were vaccinated early suggests there might be some waning of the protectiveness of the vaccine. Pfizer said in its statement last week that it also had some data from the phase 3 clinical trial of its vaccine that is also suggestive of protection waning after 6 or 8 months. But those data aren't yet public. So at this point, no one has had a chance to sort of go through the data and see if the company's claim is, you know, really justified by what the data are showing.
We should point out that U.S. officials at the FDA are also pushing back, insisting that people who are fully vaccinated do not need a booster shot at this time. That said, is there cause for concern about how long the vaccines that so many people now have will remain effective? What's our latest understanding of that?
Predictions on these vaccines have been sort of across the board. Some people have talked about the fact that they might need to be boosted annually like flu shots do. Other scientists are looking at how they activate the immune system and say these vaccines are working incredibly well and may not need to be boosted in the near term at all. It does not appear at this point that the vaccine's protection against severe disease and hospitalization and death, that seems to be holding.
So we've got the WHO and the FDA here in the U.S. both saying We don't need to be thinking about people getting booster shots right now, but you've got Pfizer and Moderna saying there's evidence that we may be getting there. Have those two companies responded to what we're hearing from the WHO?
Not as far as I know from the WHO, but certainly Pfizer reached out to the Biden administration, you know, after its statement last week and offered to brief administration officials on the data that it's seeing. That meeting happened on Monday, but details of it, like the data that they shared, still are not public.
Well, we thank you for staying on top of it for us and for joining us. Helen Branswell is with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine Publication. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Civil rights leaders are praising President Biden's speech on voting rights yesterday as a good start. Here's the president.
We're facing the most significant test of our democracy since the Civil War. That's not hyperbole.
But on the Senate floor this morning, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell had a different response.
What utter nonsense. It would be laugh out loud funny if it wasn't so completely and totally irresponsible.
Today, the president's attention shifts from voting rights to infrastructure. He's trying to get all Senate Democrats on board with an agreement reached last night on a $3.5 trillion spending plan for infrastructure and other things that Democrats think can pass without Republican support. Our political strategists join us to discuss this and more. Matt Makowiak is a Republican. Hi, Matt.
Hey there.
There you are. Glad you're there. And Jamal Simmons is a Democrat. Jamal, are you there?
I am here, too.
Excellent. Jamal, let's start with you. In this big speech yesterday, President Biden called voting rights the test of our time. But it's not on his agenda today. Infrastructure and this budget deal is. Certainly the pivot was a result of the deal that was struck, and we'll talk about that deal itself in a moment. But doesn't this just kind of leave voting rights hanging out there? I mean, a big speech is usually the prelude to a big push, right?
The president does need to do a big push on voting rights. I think a lot of activists are looking forward to that. But I take great comfort in the speech that he gave yesterday, because I think he laid the issue on the table. And I think what Joe Biden realizes is that he's got to move the American public on this issue. And not everybody is listening to cable television and watching Twitter all day, so they're not paying as much attention. By him raising the issue to people's mindset and then moving them along, he'll be able to get them to a place where they're willing to go along with something that might be a little more in your face to the Republicans. But make no mistake, what Joe Biden is doing is he is leading and trying to hold on to a coalition of the rational, I like to call it, not just a coalition of the willing, a coalition of the rational who are willing to take on the far-right Republican insurrectionist minority who are trying to hold on to a whites-first America and leave that as their legacy. I think Joe Biden is trying to bring people together to take that minority on and bring majority rule to this country.
So far, it's a coalition of the willing and the rational, as you put it, that doesn't total 60 in the Senate, though.
It doesn't total 60, but he's got to move people so that they make this a highlight. And that's where infrastructure comes in mind, because one of the reasons why some people are disaffected with the government is they want to see how the government is going to make their lives better. If he gets infrastructure dollars moving, if he's got shots in arms, he's already got money, he's going to have child poverty, put child poverty in half, it's going to start this month. This is a major push to making sure people understand government works. And then voting rights is kind of another piece of that, which is making sure that we get to have the government that the majority of Americans want.
Okay, Matt, sticking with voting rights, you're in Texas, where who can vote and how they can vote is certainly not on the back burner. What's your sense of the White House strategy on this issue, even as those Texas Democrats who fled the state are in D.C. right now pushing for passage of the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and the For the People Act?
Yeah, look, in legislative bodies, it always comes down to math. And Joe Biden has a math problem, and the Texas House Democrats have a math problem. And everything else is really secondary to that. They can break quorum. Each special session in Texas is 30 days. The governor has said he will continue to call special sessions. Eventually, they're going to have to come back for redistricting. Eventually, they're going to have to come back to their homes and their businesses and their families. They're going to run out of money to stay in cushy hotels. So they're going to probably, you know, eventually give in here in a matter of days or weeks, I imagine, in Texas. At the federal level, you know, again, it's just a math problem. And until you have enough votes in the Senate, which they're not close, I just don't know anything can happen on voting rights. Activists on the left and even some mainstream folks in the Democratic Party, federalizing elections doesn't cut. It is not a winning issue. States conduct their own elections. Counties follow state law. We had massive turnout last November. In this case, in some of these states, what you're seeing is far less than what's being reported and what's being described. Outlawing ballot harvesting, outlawing mailing out, you know, mail ballot applications or mail ballots in an unsolicited way. Those are really the central issues, and I think that's what you're going to see Republicans continue to focus on.
These are really
I don't think those really are the central issues. The central issues are one that the president brought up yesterday. It's voter nullification. It's the fact not only is it difficult for people to vote, if you do vote, state legislatures are voting to be able to supersede the authority of local control and decide which ballots are valid, which ones aren't. That's really the question. Even if you get to vote, the Republican state legislatures may decide that your votes don't count. That's really the issue here.
Matt, a quick response to that?
Well, I mean, look, if you don't like what states are doing, then you should run winning campaigns in states of electing majorities in the legislature and electing statewide officials.
We'll save that discussion and district lines and all that for another talk down the road. Okay, let's us gracefully make that same pivot the White House is making. Senate Democrats have reached an agreement on a $3.5 trillion budget deal. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer thinks it could pass, he says, under budget rules without Republicans. He spoke about it this morning.
This budget resolution will allow us to pass the most significant legislation to expand support and help American families since the New Deal. Since the New Deal, this is generational, transformational change. Every major program that President Biden has asked for is funded in a robust way.
Now, the key is keeping all of the Democrats in line on this. Democrat Mark Warner of Virginia, he's one of those more centrist Democrats, says this plan is fully paid for. Jamal, are Democrats, as best you can tell, in these hours after the deal was struck, behind this?
Joe Manchin said he is open to it. He wants to see some of the details. Senator Warner says that he believes it's paid for, which is one of the conditions Joe Manchin brought up. And, you know, Bernie Sanders have been pushing for a $6 trillion bill. It's now $3.5 trillion. So Bernie Sanders has said he's not going to stand in the way of a very big piece of legislation. It sounds like the different wings of the Democratic Party are coming on board on this because, again, Joe Biden is leading a coalition that goes from Bernie Sanders all the way over to to some of the moderate Republicans, like John McCain, Cindy McCain, Bernie Sanders all the way over to Cindy McCain, is where this coalition is. This is the majority of the American people. They want to see something happen in Washington. Joe Biden's trying to hold that majority together and get things done.
I wasn't going to let you call Liz Cheney a moderate Republican. Even
no,
obviously
no, no,
she's
no,
got
no.
her one issue that, yeah. So Matt, your take on this deal. I mean, this is the Democrats having the majority, though it's a majority that's a little trickier to hold together because it's so narrow. But what's your take on the fact that they think they can do this without Republican votes?
Yeah, so there's some big hurdles here. And look, this may be a breakthrough. And if it is, it's going to be a significant accomplishment for the Biden White House getting this major issue through. First of all, it has to meet budget reconciliation terms in order for it to be a straight party line vote. And I don't think we know the answer to that yet, number one. Number two, we have to see where Manchin and Sinema and some of the other moderate quote-unquote moderate Senate Democrats are. Without those votes, they still can't pass it, even if reconciliation is available. And then third, you have the question of what happens on the left. Does Bernie Sanders accept this? Does Pelosi accept this? Where's the squad in the House? Can this pass the House? They only have a five-seat majority on the Democratic side in the House. Is it possible that it passes the Senate and then goes back to the House and changes in a way that it can't pass the Senate? My point, there are some hurdles here. They're not nowhere near done, but this is a breakthrough, and it may be enough of a breakthrough that it gets them the accomplishment that they want.
We've got less than 2 minutes left. Maybe I'll just have you each weigh in on this. Are we already talking about 2022 when we look at these voting rights and voting restriction bills, and even when we look at something like this new budget deal? But Jamal, you first.
Yeah, probably like Matt, I'm an old political hand. We've been talking about 2022 since November of 2020. everybody who is gaming on what to do is thinking about what something's going to look like in a TV ad, or what it's going to look like in a press release, or a voting and discussion in a town hall meeting. So we're always talking about the next election. The hope is that we can get something good done before we start seeing those ads show up on TV.
Well, Matt, along those lines, what's the calculation in about 30 seconds here that Republicans are making?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be very hard to get much done next year. It's an election year. People will really be focused on their reelection and fundraising. So they've got really till the end of this year. Of course, we're coming up on the August recess. They'll be out. So they've got basically, you know, two and a half more months of legislative time to move Biden's agenda. They've gotten a few things done. They have not got the major things done. And yes, all of this is going to be viewed by the voters through the lens of the 2022 midterm elections, where Republicans are poised to take the House back, where Democrats are trying to get to that majority where maybe they could get rid of the filibuster potentially. So the stakes are really high in the upcoming midterm election, higher than I can ever remember.
All right. Matt Mikowiak is a Republican strategist. Jamal Simmons is a Democratic strategist. Thank you to both of you guys.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
A new battle over vaccines is raging in Tennessee. Just 38% of its residents are fully vaccinated against COVID-19, but the state health department is scaling back. It has stopped outreach efforts to get kids vaccinated after pressure from Republican lawmakers. And just this week, Tennessee's top vaccine official was fired over the issue. WPLN's Paige Flager joins us now for more. Hi, Paige.
Thanks, Peter.
So on Monday, the health department fired their top vaccine official, Dr. Michelle Fiscus, and then on Tuesday completely stopped outreach efforts for teens and preteens. And that's just not for COVID. It's for all diseases. What's going on?
Yeah. You know, Republican lawmakers here in Tennessee have been sort of putting up barriers, legal and otherwise, about the vaccine rollout in the state. And the situation with Michelle Fiscus, the lead immunization doctor, was basically that she sent along a guidance to vaccine providers saying that some teens, don't need parental consent in order to get the COVID vaccine. And that became sort of this hot button issue in the legislature. A month ago, they had this big sort of hearing in the legislature, and now, a month later, Michelle was fired.
And what does Dr. Fiscus say about being fired? Does she think it's politically motivated?
Yeah, absolutely. She says that basically it's a politicization of public health efforts, and that she was just doing her job. Her job as the head of this immunization program is to distribute education materials to vaccine providers, and that's what she was doing.
Well, at the health department, we understand staff are being told to strip its logos off of anything that would encourage young adults, teenagers, to get vaccinated. How do you think this became such a hot button issue in Tennessee?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think it's a continuation sort of pushback from our lawmakers about the vaccine in general. We've heard a lot of anti-vaccine rhetoric here in Tennessee. And as you said in your intro, you know, Tennessee lags behind the national average when it comes to vaccine rates. And so I think with children, it was sort of an opportunity that legislators seized upon. But it, as Fiscus says in a letter that she put out, essentially, she was just passing along what is written in state law. It's old state statute. It was given to her by lawyers from the health department. And so, you know, to fire her for the way that the legislators reacted to that document is political, inherently political. Mm-hmm. And here in Tennessee, some of our health department officials, especially the top tier health department officials, serve at the pleasure of the governor. And so she's able to be fired without given any reason for her firing.
Meanwhile, COVID cases in Tennessee have more than doubled in recent days. Is there a sense there that this decision might make things worse?
It's interesting. I think to some of the more conservative folks in the state who are already hesitant about vaccines, this is going to look good for politicians. And for liberal folks who were already vaccinated, this is going to look bad. It's very unclear if it's actually going to move the needle or if it's just sort of falling along these party lines that already existed.
WPLN's Paige Flager reporting from Nashville. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter.
Texas singer-songwriter Alejandro Escovedo has been thrilling live audiences for decades with songs like this one, 2008's Always a Friend. Wasn't I always a friend to you? Wasn't I always a friend to you? You wanna be my friend? You wanna be my friend? Every once in a while, honey, let your love show. Every once in a while, honey, let yourself go. Nobody gets hurt, no. Nobody gets hurt. Just this past week, it was announced that Escovedo, along with Lucinda Williams and the band Wilco, are the 2021 inductees into the Austin City Limits Hall of Fame. But Escovedo isn't just a performer. He's also the co-founder of the Sims Foundation, which provides help to Austin-area musicians with substance abuse and mental health issues. Today, Sims is launching the Founders Challenge to raise money in order to provide those services nationwide. Just in time, perhaps, as many musicians are making the transition back to being on the road after this past pandemic year. Alejandro Escovedo joins me via Skype. Welcome. Good to talk to you again.
It's great to hear your voice and great to be here.
Tell us more about the Sims Foundation. It's been providing services to the Austin musical community for decades, I guess. What does it do?
Well, for over 25 years, the Sims Foundation has been serving the Austin community, providing mental health service and substance use service for musicians and people in the musical community and their dependents. And not only it's not only a referral service, but it really provides intensive case care. So we follow through all the way to the end of the journey.
It's no shock to people that a lot of musicians live from gig to gig. Health insurance, especially health insurance that covers mental health, is something that they just can't afford. How does Sims actually help fill that gap?
Well, it provides mental health care for basically nothing to very, very small amounts of money, you know, by reaching out to providers that come, therapists that come and help us out. We've been able to help a lot of people. You know, initially we didn't really think of expansion in any way, but I think in the back of our minds, we always wanted to help as many people as possible, you know.
Your own music doesn't shy away from addressing pain. For example, there's the song Follow You Down, which you wrote with Stephen Barber. Let's listen to some of that.
Don't love me too much. I don't think I can take it. Little tender to the touch. feels like we can break it. I'll follow you around. And I'll follow you around. And I'll follow you down.
With the pandemic, working musicians were hit as hard as any group, I think. No live shows, no tours, no opportunity to sell merch, which is an important income stream for many. And if all that hits someone already dealing with mental health issues or substance abuse issues, I guess it states the obvious to say this has just been a horrible set of circumstances for the music community. I mean, along with so many others, but certainly for the music community.
Well, for me personally, I can tell you my story is that on March 12th, we got the word that our tour was canceled. When something is taken away from you that you've done every day of your life for 45 years, it leaves you with this kind of empty, big, gaping hole as to not only who you are, but what you do. And for some of us, I think the pause was kind of necessary. We've been working so hard, you know. But for some of us also, I think that some of those old habits started to creep back, you know. And without a way of seeking support, really. So I think we're going to see an uptick of people who really need this help.
Well, as you try to gear it up again for maybe a tour starting sometime in the fall, I want to play another song of yours, one that I know was a favorite of yours to play live. It's called Everybody Loves Me. This is from a 2009 performance of yours at the Bonnaroo Music Festival.
Well, I walk, I crawl, but I never run. Sometimes I fall away like the setting sun. Well, I swim, I surf, but I never drown. Yeah, everybody says they love me, but I don't know why.
You have a reputation as a musician that really delivers the goods at your live shows, who really connects with your audience. How has it been not to be able to do what you do best for a year and a half or so now?
It's been very strange. You know, there's been some dark periods where I just kind of sink into a hole and wonder if I'm ever going to get out of it, you know? And then there's been days where I might connect with an old friend, but it's been very weird. And I lost so many dear friends, you know, the loss. I got to tell you, when John Prine passed, it just really destroyed me, you know, and we had plans on, you know, meeting up and playing together, and then he was gone, you know. So those kind of things were very difficult to work through.
If I could reveal what I feel for you, mark my words with a gentle kiss, like St. George, I'd slay the dragon. Just to find I'd lost.
So as you prepare to step back out on stage, I mean, are you nervous, if that's the right word, or apprehensive, or eager, or all of the above?
I think all of the above. And if I have to play in a place where people are wearing masks or socially distanced and stuff, it's just, you know, I always thought that rock and roll was a contact sport, you know? It was a sweaty contact sport. We were in these small clubs just rocking hard, and the audience was rocking, and we would lift that whole occasion into some different kind of dimension, you know. And with this distancing and being kind of worried about, you know, how sanitized are the mic stands or the microphones or whatever, you know, I'm just hoping for the best, man.
Yeah. Did I spit on those people in the front row? Did my sweat get on them? Is that going to freak them
out,
right?
You know, there's all those weird concerns now. I won't be able to come out and greet people. I don't know who's vaccinated and who's not. As a performer who loved the audience, you know, I really love playing with the audience, but I love those people. And so, you know, being distanced from them in the way that I will have to be in the future, it's very, very strange.
Well, obviously, you've been at this music thing for a while. You've played with Bruce Springsteen and at the NPR Tiny Desk in probably every kind of club imaginable. Do you think about your legacy? Is it your music? Or is it also the kind of work you're doing for other musicians through an organization like the Sims Foundation?
Well, I don't know if it's for me to answer. I would like to think that people remember me as a songwriter, you know, who communicated with people and gave people something that enrich their lives in some way. But the work that I've done for the Prevent Cancer Foundation and the Sims Foundation are also equally as important to me because I think we reach a lot of people. So I love the music community. I love musicians. I was born in a family of musicians. It's been part of my life since the day I was born. So it's just what I do, I guess.
Singer-songwriter Alejandro Escovedo is the co-founder of the Sims Foundation, which provides mental health and substance abuse support to musicians. To find out more, go to hereandnow.org. Alejandro, thank you so much for talking to us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
The cruise giant Norwegian is suing Florida's Surgeon General over the state's ban on COVID-19 vaccine passports. Companies in Florida are not allowed to require that workers or customers be vaccinated, and Norwegian says that puts the company in a tough position as it readies its first post-pandemic cruise from Miami to the Caribbean next month. Dr. Jarbas Barbosa agrees. He is assistant director of the Pan American Health Organization. It's part of the World Health Organization.
The cruise lines, they have adopted some measures. They reduce the capacity. They ensure more strict protocols. But to get vaccinated before, I think that is the first step.
Getting vaccinated is the safest step, he says, especially if cruises are headed to a region where vaccination rates are mostly still low.
The situation in the Caribbean is very diverse. We have some countries that have reached a very good immunization coverage. Around 40-50% of their population are vaccinated. For instance, Cayman Islands, Bonaire, Aruba, Curaçao. But in other countries and islands, the vaccination is still in a very low place.
A spokesperson for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis calls Norwegian's lawsuit over his vaccine passport ban disappointing. They say the cruise line is discriminating against people who can't be vaccinated or choose to opt out for reasons of religion or conscience. Norwegian has threatened to leave Florida if the ban stays in place. Our next story takes us across the globe to India, where single-screen cinemas were used for decades before multiplexes came along. Some were large enough to seat 1,000 people, and they had unique architectural character. The atmosphere inside used to be charged up, people dancing along with the film or throwing coins at the screen. But these old cinemas have been struggling for years, and as Sushmita Pathak reports from Mumbai, the pandemic could be their greatest challenge so far.
So we just entered the Central Plaza Theater. It's this gorgeous white building, curved contours, typical Art Deco style. There's still a placard that says house full, but obviously it's been empty for a while now.
Yes, we have got very, very nice, good, fond memories of this place. But at the same time, it's just not possible to operate anymore.
When India's government announced a coronavirus lockdown last year, Sharad Doshi knew that his single-screen cinema was doomed. So in the spring of 2020, nearly a century after it opened, Mumbai's Central Plaza Theatre shut down forever.
The very first day of the COVID, we made a decision on the very first day of the closure that now the audience is not going to come back to us.
Single-screen cinemas have been in a slump for decades. The challenges have arrived in waves. TV, then videotapes. Soon they were edged out by big multiplexes that offered viewers the choice of several movies at once. Now people can watch a film from their couch.
Netflix is there, Amazon Prime is there, you know, so many streaming platforms are there. Why would you come?
Doshi says the taxes on his theatre are so high that it doesn't make sense financially to continue. Cinema owners across India have similar complaints.
In the last 20 years, I think the number of cinemas, single-screen cinemas in India had dwindled from 20,000 to 9,000.
Hemant Chaturvedi is a former cinematographer. who's photographed about 650 theaters in more than 500 towns.
Each one has its own architectural uniqueness. Unlike multiplexes, which are just replicated without any emotion whatsoever.
Chaturvedi says watching a movie in a single-screen cinema was about sharing the experience with hundreds of strangers.
You go to a multiplex, everyone is being really polite and, you know, shushing each other. And you don't express yourself in any way. Whereas in a single-screen cinema, there was all the hooting and, you know, seat shaking and coins being flung and people having, you know, emotional breakdowns along with the stars.
Inside old cinemas, Chaturvedi says he's found interesting things.
Some of them still have their old projectors, so you find all kinds of old equipment. You wait to see which hero or which heroine's image you're going to find on the men and women's loos on the doors.
In one theater in Rajasthan, he found an old reel of an erotic movie. Some theaters had started screening those when regular movies didn't do well. Chaturvedi says cinemas adapted to keep up with the changing industry. But pandemic closures have crushed what little hope they had. At a roadside shop across the street from Central Plaza in Mumbai, 78-year-old Meghashyam Mahimkar sips tea. He's lived in this neighborhood almost his entire life, he says. He's heartbroken that the theater is closing. This theater was like a temple to me and my friends, Mahimkar says. Nowadays, he watches videos on his smartphone, but says it's no match for watching films in a theater. When the stranger next to you cracks a joke and the entire row erupts in laughter. For NPR News, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Mumbai.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Don Gagne. It's Here and Now.